Accession number 19990, reel 23.
Chief Technician Roper, reel 23. I think you were saying that you'd have preferred to stay at Leconfield.
Oh, yes. But in moving to the engine bay, it meant that I would move with the headquarters to Finningley. This had been a very hush-hush business. I was party to the talks that were first given with the Army, where the Army were sort of preparing to move up from Borden in Hampshire. And everybody was sworn to secrecy. It was mainly the senior officers who had to be aware of what was going on and when things were going to happen. But because of the flight and the fact that the CO was seriously ill in hospital, and the person who was deputising him didn't really know what it was all about, I was taken to the meetings that they had with a minister from the government, senior army officers and the CO of the station and the wing commanders, etc. And I shouldn't really have been there. But what annoyed me was we had young airmen that were posted into Leconfield that were preparing to buy houses, that were waiting to exchange contracts, and the hierarchy knew that they would be posted within 3 or 4 months, and they were letting these things go ahead without informing the station as to what was going on. And
why were they keeping it so secret?
I don't really know. It was obviously going to happen. The army had come up. They discussed their requirements for what needed to be changed, and I can remember that the first thing on the agenda was that the guard room wasn't big enough. They needed an extra 6 cells, and I thought, this is a bit strange. And then they were talking about traffic lights on the main runways to simulate autobahns and so on. And there was talk of what would be put at Driffield, these big mounds for sort of rough terrain driving and so on. And the army seemed to, well, they were envisaging presumably what they'd had at Borden fitted into RAF Leconfield. But where most of the hierarchy knew what was exactly what was going to happen and when the army proposed to move in and so on, nobody let the young airmen know. And eventually, I think it, through talking with what I'd found out and talking to the CO and others... Now, where had we got to?
You're saying that you think the news got out eventually to the airmen.
Well, the thing was that I remonstrated about this particular airman. I said, you're allowing a young man there to buy his house, which you know he'll probably be posted miles away. And I said, apart from the expense it will put him to, it's wrong. And eventually there were announcements made that stopped this sort of thing happening. But all we did was we moved across to Finningley. Now, because I was quite happy, my family had settled in Beverley. I'd bought my house in Beverley. The children were at their respective schools, and my wife was quite happy. She had had enough of moves, so I became a bean stealer at Finningley. Now, fortunately, Finningley was only 44 miles away, and so we used to go to work on Monday morning, return on Friday night.
A weekly commuter.
Yes. And, of course, this caused problems with certain people because the Air Force, the single man, was given so much money and then part of it was taken back for his board and lodgings, whereas the married man doing this bean stealing, we got it free.
Because you were living away from home?
Yes. The bean stealers became a bit of a sort of thing with the single men. They didn't see why they should be paying, and we were ate free. But that was one of these things. And I stole beans for, I think, almost 6 years before leaving the service, age 47.
What work were you doing at this engine bay at Leconfield that got moved to Finningley? What was the...
Well, the engine bay at Leconfield was a very small bay. It was holding the spare engines. It did modifications to the engines that were normally, when the aircraft was on a major servicing, the engine would be removed anyway. And it was an opportunity during that time to do any mods that had come in, or to do any serious repair work. It also housed an early failure detection centre, as we'd had in Hong Kong.
What was that, the same kind of work as you've been doing in Hong Kong?
It was on the Whirlwind engines, yes. Whereas Hong Kong had been Whirlwind and later the Wessex, yes. which was the thing. And of course, on moving across to Finningley, the headquarters from the south of England for 22 Squadron, which covered the south of England, moved up to Finningley, and so the whole of SAR servicing, because Finningley is the most central RAF station in the country, and it meant that we are now getting the Wessex, which is a longer range helicopter. And they knew that the Sea King was going to come in. And so Finningley would be a base with no Whirlwinds. They'd have Sea Kings and Wessex. 202 Squadron, which had been the Northern Squadron, would be the Sea King Squadron. And 22 Squadron from the south of England would become the Wessex Squadron. And so... it was a major change anyway. There was an upheaval, but of course most of us had worked Wessex anyway, and the Sea King people had been, there were new people trained to come back with the Sea King. Much of the operation would be the same, but the range of operation would be greatly enhanced, and there were sort of subtle differences in the engines, but they were still gnomes, and most parts were recognisable. Yeah.
So the Sea King was an improvement on the Wessex, but it wasn't that different from your point of view as the...
Well, not engine-wise. Yes. You know, the engines... The parameters for operation, for power output and so on, were greater. And there were one or two modifications which were new to us, and the installation is different. On the whole, they were, you know, it's just the same engine with a few different bits on it. Mm-hmm. And on getting to Finningley, because the engine bay was going to be more important and it had to be set up, and of course I'd done it before, I was given the task of setting up the engine bay for servicing Wessex and Sea King gnomes. And this was quite an enjoyable job. And we also got a test bed. Really, because of my specialist qualifications, because there wasn't so many people that had done the deep servicing gnome courses, and also used to using the test bed. It was a nice little job for me, and of course I was still expected to help in the hangar with the independent checks, and one of the jobs of the engine bay chief, because the flights are scattered around the coast, and they tend to, where you're not operating a lot of aircraft, you don't get a lot of snags. So at Odeum, they would probably have more experience in 6 months of operating 40 helicopters than a man on a flight operating two would gain in 5 or 6 years. Mm. And so when an aircraft used to go unserviceable at, say, Bulmer, they'd ring back to the engine bay at Finningley, and they'd say, we've got this problem, we have done so and so and so and so. And of course they'd probably be offline, or they'd be desperate to get the aircraft serviceable. And what they really needed was some moral support for someone to make the decision and say, change the engine. Or if there was something they'd missed, we'd say, well, look, there's one thing that you can check. Check this and get back to me. And they'd check it and get back to you, and they'd say, right, well, you've got to change such and such a component. Or you'd make the decision. And of course, the CO there might not be in agreement, but he was then dealing with me rather than his poor shift boss, who was probably out of his wits, or he might not have even been an engine fitter, he was probably an airframe fitter or something. So we were constantly on call by telephone. Quite often they hadn't got the spare parts that they needed, and we'd have to get them to them, or on some occasions we'd say, well, can you fly the aircraft down here and we'll do the checks and send it back to you. And you liaised very closely, and this was not just on the engine side, also on the airframe side. And we had a centralised EFDC at Finningley, which was also part of my little empire, and they used to sort of they'd pick up traces of, say, copper, and they'd say, you've got traces of copper.
You're saying you had an early failure detection centre there, and you were, if you're looking, you said last thing you said something about finding traces
of
copper.
That's right. If you found an unusual in the oil, the spectroil analysis, or the or on the magnetic detector, you find a lot of ferrous metal, you'd then sort of have to contact the flight and say, look, there's a gearbox and it's developing a problem. What we'd like you to do is to drop the filters, see how bad they are, and we want you to up the frequency of the checks on the magnetic plugs and the oil sample. And this they would do. You'd say, I want it every 10 hours instead of every 25, or what have you. And we would then liaise with the central early failure detection centre down, either through Rolls-Royce at Leavesden, who operate the engines or built the engines, or through Harefield, which is the centre of all this detection. The army, with their tanks and things, also use Harefield and the Army Air Corps, etc. And of course, with their experience, if you had a failing gearbox, they would normally be in a position to say, we know what it is not critical, even if it fails, this is all that will happen. And when you're talking about a huge main rotor gearbox, say on a Sea King, they might have to fly one or get one from the manufacturers to replace it. It might take a week to position the spare, but also you would be better to position the aircraft at a major base like Finningley to do the change. And so it gave us enough time to sort of get our act together and be ready to do a major job of that sort of nature, and also supply the reserve aircraft to take the aircraft place that you were working on.
It sounds as though you're really in the role of a consultant at this stage to the flights that were around the coast.
Well, that was just part of the job. And usually the flights were very good. The people on them had sort of come to the right conclusion, but they were not prepared to make the decision. Usually through the pressure that would be put on them, because nobody wants to do a lot of work, which might be unnecessary anyway. But also, you know, if you change an engine and then you find out it was some simple little thing that the twist of a screw would have corrected, they would sort of be in a very bad light. And quite often they weren't as experienced anyway, because of the length of time on the aircraft or the fact that they'd never done second line servicing, they'd only been on first line servicing. So this was how it worked. And of course it was good for me, because every snag that occurred I got to know about it, and I also got to know about what the remedy was, which built up my experience. And you got things that went in phases. And of course we were in touch with Rolls-Royce, with Westland Helicopters, because not all problems could we solve. And you'd ring the factory and say, well look, we've got this problem, we've done this, we've done that, and nothing. Is there anything else we could do? And they would take some time, but probably get back to you and say, well, just check that such and such is all right, and if that's the case, change the engine. But it worked quite well.
Another thing you mentioned is an engine health monitoring data. Well, what was that?
No, well, this is the Early Failure Detection Centre. What we did was to, every, say, 25 hours, you'd take a sample of the engine oil, and you would take the magnetic chips out, there'd probably be three or four of them. You would put them under a microscope, and you always get a little bit of iron filings or what have you, and the oil, of course, has got all sorts of material in it. And providing it looked all right, you sent that off to Harefield, who put it under their bigger microscope, the electron microscope, and they'd also do spectroil analysis by burning the oil, and they could tell you exactly how many parts of antimony or whatever alloy was present. And they may well detect something that, because it wasn't ferrous metal where we could normally make the decision, they detect a high level of titanium or something. Now, they know the component, and they know the bits of that component that are made from this particular material, and they'd say, you have a problem with the front bearing on such and such, and although it's not critical yet, will you monitor this? And it might just be that one gearbox, but we'd go down to, say, 10 hours, every 10 hours, or even every flight, you must give me a sample from that particular area, and we'd keep it monitored until either Harefield was satisfied that it was just a hiccup, or that we had a failure, I wouldn't even say imminent failure, but it was sort of something that had to be remedied.
How many men did you have working for you at Finningley when you were running that show?
I'd probably have one or two in the engine bay and one in the EFDC, with probably an assistant if necessary. We could always give him a man if he was snowed under or to cover his leave. The Air Force, in its wisdom, created a number of people called ATECs. And these were airmen that had been through Halton, and they were trained in all trades. During the war and just after, they had fitter ones, which were airframe and engine fitters that could do both jobs. But these lads were airframe engines, electrical, armament and instruments. And the thing, they were wonderful. Most of the ones on the flights, because you had too few electricians, to cover leave for the electrician, the ATEC always stood in. And so on the flight, he was usually standing in for electrical and instruments. But also, he could stand in for the engine fitter, the airframe fitter, and they were a tool that we couldn't have managed without. They were really jack of all trades, but masters of none. In the Navy, they have people call pilot's mates, so that you only need one man and he can do every job on the aircraft to get it airborne, but this is usually at first line level.
Yes, not deep servicing.
Not the deeper servicing, but these ATECs, they had been given intensive training. Most of the helicopter ATECs were trained at Odeon, and they spent 6 or 8 weeks in the engine bay, 6 or 8 weeks in the hydraulic bay, 6 or 8 weeks in the tyre bay, and went through every phase of the servicing and the deeper servicing. And usually, I always said, well, you could pick out what they should have been, you know, because you could always tell the man who was a radio man or the man who was engine fitters and armourers tend to be heavy hammer men. Riggers tend to be brainless and so on, and you can always say, oh yes, typical rigger, and a little bit of inter trade rivalry. And most of these ATECs, you'd say, oh, he's a good electrician, but he's not so hot on the other side of it. But they were the most useful tool we had.
Did you have a turnover of staff while you were at Finning, or did most of them stay for the time you were there?
No, most of them were fairly permanent. Occasionally you would be asked to go and either run a flight or something, but nobody really wanted to do it, because the majority were well settled in local houses that they owned themselves. Mm. And so the Air Force was becoming sort of an 8-till-5 job. There was very little opportunity for going overseas. Occasionally you would have to go to a flight to back up there, usually to take specialist equipment and probably the spare part and help them get the aircraft serviceable and do checks and so on for them. But it was more or less an 8-till-5 job.
When you eventually came to leave the Air Force, did they give you a thorough resettlement training?
Yes, I can remember that I went up to Perth to look into being a tech author. There were a lot of job opportunities in tech authorship, sometimes with the ministry. Others were interested in going to Harrogate to work for MOD in a sort of supply, computerised supply establishment there. But I went up and thought about the tech authorship, and then I elected to go to Danby near Colchester to do a small business course, and it was a very good course. We had a number of personnel there. There was one young army officer who had been seriously injured by a bomb in Northern Ireland, and whilst we were on the course he featured on a large BBC television programme about he'd suffered serious brain damage through the bomb, and it was quite a moving story, his story, and he was doing the course with us, and there were a number of fairly senior either officers or warrant officers, and they were all going into different sort of small businesses, but the instruction we got were from experts. And I've still got the notes somewhere. I don't know whether it did my particular business any good, but at least it made you feel more comfortable with starting a business and knowing a few more things about the pitfalls.
Did you find it difficult to readjust to civilian life when you did leave the Air Force?
No, I didn't miss the Air Force. It had started to go sour in 1971, and it wasn't getting any better. But I missed the money, and I missed my friends, but the job, no, and the Air Force in general, no. You know, I mean, I still look back on my service in the early days, particularly the 50s and 60s, it was a great Air Force, possibly because the veterans were still in it. I mean, you can go on parade these days and there's probably three or four medal ribbons, you know, but when you were standing next to somebody who had three rows and had been either Aircrew Europe or something like that, it made you very proud to be able to serve with these sort of people. But also, of course, it was like the rats leaving a sinking ship. The people that you'd, your contemporaries, that you had every respect for, that were very, very good trade people, left the services. There was a sort of brain drain and experience drain, mainly because the civilian employers, particularly in the aircraft industry, were offering much better pay. So the Air Force tended to keep those who didn't have much chance of getting these sort of jobs. And you watched people that you knew would never have been promoted 5 years before shooting up in rank, and you thought, good Lord, has he got that, you know? And as I say, it disillusioned a lot of us. And so I decided to come out. 47, you sort of become pensionable at 22 years service, and then it gradually increases up to the age of 47, and then it more or less levels out till 55, which is the time you should leave. Well, by the time I reached 47, I thought the only way for me is down, and I'd better get out while I'm still ahead. So I came out while I was still able to start a small business. I could have signed on. And the other thing was, of course, that after at that time, they were even signing on people year after year after year up to the age of 58. But I was glad I'd left it, because the politics that were creeping in, and you could see decisions being made either because they wanted to keep a station open that had a high area of unemployment, and there were decisions that were not logical decisions, particularly on the servicing side. One of the things that most annoyed me, and I made my feelings felt at the highest level, we'd always had problems at Odeon keeping our engines clean. Because a lot of them were operating in Germany, you built up this dust and soot and on the engine. And we used to wash them with kerosene and water mix. Of course, in the winter, where you're using water, there's a chance that it'll freeze, so you have to use alcohol with the water to do these washes. Now, on the SAR side, on the search and rescue side, they were just using plain water in summer, but lots of it, and in winter, water and alcohol mix. And this was done daily, and the engines, when you took the lids off, were gleaming. No problems at all. Odeon, who didn't wash very often and had to use kerosene and water, their engines, when you took the lid off, were still fairly grubby. And so they experimented with neat kerosene, they experimented with various other solutions, but they came up with a stuff called Rivenaise. And this was very, very expensive, and on SAR we would be using a large amount of it. Now, we were quite happy with just using plain water and alcohol in winter, but we weren't happy with the method of applying it, because you had a silly heavy little trolley which you had to wheel out to the aircraft. It had to be pressurized and so on, and what we really wanted was something that you could drive alongside the aircraft with, that held 50 or 100 gallons of washing fluid, and you could wash the whole line of aircraft, four engines or six engines, without having to replenish the thing and mix it and so on. but they were going to force onto us the use of the Ribbonase. And I knew, I'd spoken with Odium,